This is David Colburn. I'm interviewing Bill Cross. We're talking about his experiences in World War II. We're at Bill's home. This is March 30th, 2010. And Bill, if we could, we'll start with just asking you about your rank during World War II and the time you served.
Well, I went in the Marine Corps. I enlisted in April of 1943, just before I graduated from high school. And as soon as I graduated, within about a week, I was at the Marine Recruit Depot in San Diego, California. And this is where I got my basic training. And from there, during a period of time that I was a recruit, I went to the Marine Rifle Range at Camp Matthews in La Jolla, California, and I was fortunate enough to score the highest in the platoon that I was in, so they asked me to serve as an instructor on the rifle range. And I did that for a while, but I really wasn't a very good instructor because it was really a rapid pace, and I was only 17 years old. I really couldn't keep up, and so they put me in the MPs there at Camp Matthews. And from there I was...
What year?
That was 1943.
43, okay. Yeah. So why don't we pause right there and sort of drift back and talk a little bit about your youth and where you were born, your family, what your dad, mom did. These were pretty rough years because it was the Great Depression. But anyway, start with when you were born and where you were born.
Yeah, I was born in 1925 in Missouri. That's where my parents were from, Missouri. But my mother just went to Missouri to have me, and then she really went back to Kenosha, Wisconsin, right after I was born, and that's where I grew up until I left to go in the Marine Corps.
Now, why did she go from Kenosha to Missouri?
Just to have me.
Did she have family there?
Yeah, that's where my family came from, Missouri.
Okay. And so your grandparents?
Yeah, all of them.
There. Okay. And what was your mother doing in Kenosha, Wisconsin?
My dad worked for a hosiery company, Allen A, at the time. Fortunately, Dad had not a good job, but it was a steady job, and he was able to work all during the Depression. And we're one of the few families that I grew up with that when I went to school, at least I had shoes and shirt and a jacket. The Depression days were still very vivid in my mind at present time. I can still see people being picked up to go to work in WPA and young people going into CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps. I can still see the people at Nash Automobile Company where they were picketing to gain recognition. It was an interesting time, especially going to school during those times, because some of the kids that I remember very, very vividly who didn't have any food when they come to school. We didn't have lunch counters at that time. You walked to school. And in that time, I can still remember very vividly my mother putting her in her galoshes and wrapping a scarf around her. And we walked to school in the morning, walk home for lunch, walk back after lunch, and then walking home and through the snow that would probably go up to our, well, sometimes it would be well up to our waist.
And now, your mother and father were in Kenosha. Did you have any other family members in Kenosha?
No. I had two brothers. They were twin brothers.
Tell me about your brothers. Were they younger or older?
They were 2 years younger than I. And
were they twins?
Yep.
Okay.
They were twins. So we grew up with three boys in the house.
And your mother, what is she? She was a housewife.
She was a housewife, but during those days she worked at the grocery store, Kroger, for 25 cents an hour. And because that helped us with a little better living, at least we had heat in the house and we had a car to drive, and and the like.
How big was Kenosha?
I think it probably was around 45 to 50,000 when I was growing up.
So a fairly good-sized city for that time.
Very heavily industrialized community, especially a lot of immigrants, Italian immigrants there. I could probably cuss in Italian before I could cuss in English.
And what brought them there? Were they working at one of the factories?
Jobs. Mm-hmm. There were clubs of all nationalities. There was a Russian-American club, the German-American club, the Italian-American club, the Scandinavian-American club, the Norwegian club. Go ad infinitum. There are these clubs of these ethnic groups. And there was a very ethnic group, and primarily Italians, who came from what they call the boot, down in Sicily and in the lower part of Italy. And there was quite a bit of the mafia influence even in those days. And I still remember that very, very vividly. And I can still tell you some of the kids' names, Italian names, that I remember very well going to school with. And every once in a while I'll hear about them, but don't keep contact with them. I've been away so long.
I'm going to get this chair and sit so I can look at you. While we're doing this, a set of twists. And you can sit back in that chair, by the way. This will pick you up quite comfortably. So you just need to make yourself comfortable.
All right.
You don't have to speak into it. It's very, very fine recorder. Well, tell us a little bit about life and school in the Great Depression. You talked about your mother walking you to school. You talked about some of the poverty that existed. People didn't have food for breakfast when the kids, when they came to school. What was your school years like during the 1930s?
Actually, one of the things I will say that the school system there in my hometown was very good. There were good schools in terms of construction. We had good teachers. I can still remember some of the names of the teachers that I had. And one of the things that I remember so well is being hurtled down to the main room where there was a lot of people. You can sit on the floor and listen to classical music and narrated by Walter Damrosch. And that's where I learned to love classical music. Back from my high school days, listening to Walter Damrosch talk about it. And I can remember listening to opera when I was a young man driving a grocery truck. So the schools were very good. They had good athletic programs. It's just a lot of poverty there.
Mm-hmm. Did you play sports in middle school or junior high or high
soccer.
School?
Soccer.
You played soccer.
Yeah.
And why soccer? How did you happen to, that's an unusual sport to play back in the 1930s.
Well, it was a very popular sport back in the 1930s in this community. It was in middle school. So there were four middle schools, so we had competition. We didn't have to go out of town. It was just something I decided to do. It wasn't not anything my father asked me to do or anything anybody else asked me to do. I just said, well, I'm going to try to play soccer. And so I kicked the ball around for a while.
Well, I would imagine the Italians played a lot of soccer, didn't they? They probably brought that with them.
The Italians there.
Mm-hmm.
And they played boccia.
Ah.
And we used to watch them play boccia, and then they played this, what they call moro, with their hands. You know, you could call out numbers, and you cut out the fingers and the like. Excellent bakeries, Italian bakeries there. Going out to dinner, you mainly went to Italian restaurants. And one of the things I do remember, David, is Friday night was fish night at all the local bars there. And there were thousands of local bars in that community. And they opened at 5 in the morning and closed about 2 in the morning. Because workers going to work would stop and get a couple of shots before they went into the factory and work in those pretty rough conditions. But anyways, on Friday night, I remember my parents, we always seemed to go because you could get a fish dinner for a nickel. And then, of course, the beer was a little bit more when they relied on their sales of alcohol to cover up. But We used to go out for fish there, and I can, you know how vivid these things are. I can still taste that fish and the French fries and the Cokes that we had. There was always one of them. Hell, this is 19 in the 30s. Steve Crocs. I could still drive to Steve Crocs right now. So those things are very
Steve
vivid.
Crocs, a pub?
You have no idea.
And a sort of restaurant as well?
They had a kitchen back there. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much a restaurant as a kitchen. You have no idea how many bars are in that community there. You have no idea. It was, if they did, there was one on practically every corner, it seemed like. And they were nice places. They were family places. Sure, you see some guys abused it, but mainly they were family places where you get a hamburger or something. There wasn't a lot of money to spend on that sort of thing. They had to watch their money pretty closely. I remember Mother and Dad, you know, they provided for us, but they allowed themselves a little bit of an expense at on a Friday or Saturday night to go somewhere, go to the movies. It was 10 cents to go to the movie. And so,
what was the, did you live in a predominantly ethnic community, or predominantly, I mean, do the Italians live in one section of town, and
yes,
you and your family lived in another section?
Yeah, we never lived in what we call Little Italy, and that was really predominantly Italian. They were good people, worked hard. Those people, they were immigrants. Most of the people were first boaters, as we called them,
mm-hmm.
and they worked hard. They wanted to provide a better life for their families. Built nice homes, and
was there a little Germany and a little Russian, or was there?
Well, you would find little areas of it, but not much. Not much of the Italians, mm-hmm. but most of their getting together were in these social clubs, the German American Club, the Danish American Club, and the like. They met there on Fridays and Saturdays, and they always had something going on, and. I can tell the story now that when, after the war, right after the war, we weren't eligible to drink because I was 17, couldn't drink then. We'd look in the paper on Saturday and see where the weddings were. And if there was in a good ethnic group, we'd go over there and crash the wedding. And we'd eat all the good food that they provided because most of it was homemade. And drink their beer and the like. We didn't have any idea who the groom or the bride was or anybody. We just cried. And we did that repeatedly, having a blast. A bunch of dang ex-veterans that had, you know, gotten out of service, and a lot of them were going to school. And
what was this? What was the sort of expectation your parents had for you as you got older and were in high school and so forth? Did they, was there expectation you'd go to college, or did they just hope you'd get a job, or what was the thinking within the family? And you were the oldest, you were the oldest son.
In those days, they knew what was going to happen to me. I was going to have to go in the military. They knew it was going to happen to the other two boys. They're going to have to go in the military. Because that's exactly what happened to everybody. But fortunately, I graduated from high school. And college was not even mentioned in those days, because none of my family, I'm the first one in the family that had got a college degree, or I think even went to college. They may have gone to a business place or something like that, business school, but I was the first one. So there was no expectation of my parents of what I was going to do other than go in the military and come home and probably get a job at one of the local factories there, which there were dozens of them.
Did you have a sense, you would have been about 16 years old when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Up to that point, did you have any sense prior to Pearl Harbor that your family or you would be involved in a war?
Probably not. But I can tell you where I was on December 7th. My parents had gone to visit some friends in Chicago. My crew brothers and I were down on State Street, one of the theaters. We came out of the theater, and there was just tremendous explosion of people, and they were all running. They were, you know, they couldn't believe that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. It was almost confusing at the time for the people to realize that we were now in a war. And we took the streetcar to where my parents were, and we then drove to Kenosha. And the next day, of course, you listened to President Roosevelt declare war on the Japanese. And then you knew what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, prior to that, what was your family's view? What was Kenosha's view of Franklin Roosevelt as president?
Oh, Franklin Roosevelt, at least in my parents, and in the nation, because it proved it in the vote. My parents thought Roosevelt was next to Jesus. I didn't have much sense about that. I know if I ever said anything against Roosevelt, my father would probably beat me to death. He couldn't stand that. But my dad was pretty strong on Roosevelt. Well, the nation was, actually, the nation was.
And did your teachers in school, particularly high school, did they talk about the New Deal and Roosevelt's leadership at all? Or that was really current history. I don't know if they raised that in the classroom then or not, when they talked about history of
politics. I don't remember any of that. Mm-hmm. I remember you went to take a math course, you studied math. You mm-hmm. went to take a drawing class, you did drawing. I don't remember any discussions about Roosevelt.
Tell me how did the classical music experience and the opera experience come to be in high school? I mean, was it one teacher who did that, or was it a
school? No, the whole school did it.
The whole school did it.
The whole school would gather in this commons area. It's Roosevelt Elementary School. And it was an old radio. I don't know if you can remember how these big radios mm-hmm. with the tubes and the like. And it wasn't a good reception. And Walter Damrosch spoke with a very much of an accent, and it's somewhat difficult to understand him. But the music you did. You understood the music. He told about it. And I just one of those things it took. Classical music is beautiful. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, none of our kids now know what classical music is.
Yeah, they're not exposed to it like you were in elementary school. That's quite remarkable. I don't ever remember my parents or grandparents talking about, especially my parents, talking about that kind of experience in the public school system, where you'd come, all the elementary kids would come together. That's quite remarkable.
Yeah, I think so. As I said, it took. Mm-hmm. And that's what's interesting about it.
Well, what kind of student were you?
Oh, I was a horrible student. I would get my C's. I was not a good student. My parents, I think my dad maybe got to sixth grade or something. He worked in a mine in Missouri. It was a pretty rough area, a lot of Italians in those mines. And Saturday night they get drunk and they carry their pistols around. Dad used to tell me stories about that. Well, I remember some of the little things, but not the real shootings and the things around those mines. So I didn't have much of a family desire for education. You know, we go to school, you're going to school, but they never said anything about our grades. If you go from fifth to the sixth grade and sixth to the seventh, that was what was important.
So what did your teachers think of you?
Some of them, typically I was a little rebellious because I was with those Italians most of the time. I wouldn't think they thought a lot of me. Some of them did, because I was a little rebellious.
How about church? Were you active in the church? Did your family go to church every Sunday, or how was that?
My grandfather was a horseback riding minister. My father was a fairly religious person in the sense that he really liked it. In his latter years of life, he would go to the nursing homes and preach to them on Sunday. Mother's family, her father was an alky. Working in those dang mines, I would assume that you get up, that's what you had to do to go back to work the next day. I don't think people understand how difficult it was to have to go down in those mines all day long and get up there and know you're going to have to go back down the next day.
Was your grandfather a Baptist preacher?
He was just one of those guys that rode around on a horse and went to these communities and preached. There was not that much organized religion at that time. Sure, in Missouri, which is real rural where they were from, the blacks probably had better religion than the whites did at that time. But around in, there was a Pentecostal church that we used to go to, especially the kids. Dad say, you go to the Pentecostal church. It was Foursquare Gospel, Amy Simple McPherson. I don't know if you ever, he was quite a personality in California. But we didn't have a real strong religious background, but it was there. I mean, it was not practicing, but it
did you go? Did you ever go to church with your Italian buddies or to the Catholic Church, or did they even go?
No, my father was as strong as anti-Catholic. I could have married anybody in the world except a Catholic. He was strongly anti-Catholic.
What do you think of you hanging around with your Italian friends?
Well, we had enough social Italian friends who were, they played a lot of cards. Going from one house to another playing cards. Wind up eating spaghetti most of the time. Which was good, and I still love it. But it's not any good compared to what we had those days with the, they would make all their spaghetti from real tomatoes.
And tell me about, was your dad in the Union?
No.
He was not a Union member.
No, he was not. He was management, and he didn't have to be, and he did not care much about the unions.
Yeah.
It was prevalent in that community. Oh, the unions were strong. Very strong.
Any strikes when you were there?
Oh, hell yes. Oh, my gosh, yes.
And would they get violent when the workers struck?
You would find some fights, but they were pretty, not big ones. There were, two or three guys getting in a fight over unions and non-unions. But you see, we had so many that made Simmons mattresses there. Nash Automobile became American Motors. I had McWhite Wire and Cable Company, Peter Parrish, the fire thing, American Brass. Well, I can't. That's I'm sure there are others, but I can't remember them right now. But there was a lot of tool and die making there. So there was a lot of union activities, especially in the 30s when they were trying to get recognized. Just fighting for recognition.
Mm-hmm.
They would build bonfires in these big steel metal oil barrels. And they'd keep strikes 24 hours a day. They would be out there on the picket line and they'd keep warm because Kenosha was damn cold in the wintertime.
Now, did you work when you went to high school?
I worked in grocery stores. I worked for an Italian grocery store, Piguirotti, and Del Frate, and Cavelli.
And what did you do in the store?
I did everything they asked me to do. Delivered a lot. you know, waiting on customers, stocking shelves, whatever they ask you to do. Well, but you get 25 cents an hour and you thought you were died and gone to heaven. Because that was a, I mean, you got $10 in your pocket, man. You were a wealthy kid.
And the folks you worked for, was it a family-owned business?
Yes. It was a bunch of brothers from Italy that started this store. There were five of them stores. Mm. Heck of times, I would go down to Chicago to the markets and with the, one of the owners, and we'd bring back all of fruits and vegetables they needed for the next week. And sometimes I'd drive that truck down there. Loaded, I mean, I'm sure it was overloaded. I'm sure that we, if it, police would have been cared at that time, we would have been arrested for overweight, because driving that thing was miserable, because if you wanted to brake, you broke 10 miles, start to put the brake on 10 miles before you get there. It was so heavy.
And as you were in high school, did you play sports in high school?
No.
So you were working and doing your studies and having basically what time you had off, you enjoyed it with your friends.
Yeah, there was there was a lot of recreational activity around that community. A lot of dances for young people. And the churches and the YMCA. It cost a dime to get in. And they're very, very well-mannered, too. Only once in a while you'd see a fight. Usually between two Italians, it seemed like, at the time. But there's a tremendous number of dances, so I went to all the dances I could go. And, of course, in the summertime, we were right on Lake Michigan. You know, I could ride my bike there in 15 minutes to get to the beach. And so you went to the beach a lot during the summertime. And the water was probably around 20 degrees, and you're freezing to death. But you go to the beach because it was sunny, and that was where the people were.
Did you have a sense that the American economy was getting stronger, that the Depression was nearing its end? Did your folks have that experience, or was things pretty much the same?
Well, the Nash Automobile Company was doing military work. They were making engines for airplanes at the time. Very secure there, man. If you even step your foot in there, as I did one time, boy, a guard came running out after you. You know. So there was a lot of military. And you see, we were real close to Great Lakes Naval Training Station. So on the weekend, the streets were white during the summer and they were blue in the other times of the year. I can still see the North Shore train that went from Chicago to Milwaukee unloading those sailors. There were just thousands and thousands of sailors. Well, they could get a hamburger somewhere, or if they were old enough, they could get a beer. But getting a beer when you were 16 was easy, too, mm-hmm. because they weren't going to stop those sailors.
You're in your last year of high school, am I right?
Yeah.
When Pearl Harbor occurred and you graduated that spring
in
42?
No, I was...
When did you graduate?
Pearl Harbor was 1941. I graduated in 1943.
Okay. So you were a junior in high school at
right,
that time.
Right.
And so you finished high school, and as soon as you finished, did you get a draft notice, or how did that work?
No, I enlisted in the Marine Corps before I graduated, before I could turn 18. I was 17 when I enlisted.
And how long before you graduated did you enlist?
Oh, probably about 3 months.
3 months. And were your fellow students, male students, doing the same?
Some of them were, but I was probably one of the few that did, enlisted in the Marine Corps.
Why the Marine Corps?
I didn't want to be in the Army for some reason. Didn't want to be in the Navy for some reason. That left me with the Marine Corps. And I met a couple of Marines, and I decided that blue uniform looked better than the Army
green.
Colors, yeah, greens or whatever
they are. And those bell bottoms they wore in the Navy.
Yeah, the old bell bottoms. Oh, my God, yes. I didn't want to go in the Navy. I knew that.
Now, did any of your really close friends sign up with you when you...
Yeah, there were several guys that went out the same time I did. They hadn't graduated. They never graduated from high school. They came back and took that GED program.
After the war.
Yeah. And one of them wound up as a colonel in the Air Force. Mm. And one of them, we never did find out what happened to him. He moved to Detroit and we never heard any more about him.
How many, did you go down with some friends or did you go down by yourself to sign up?
By lonesome.
By yourself.
Went up to Milwaukee.
And what did your parents think of that?
Well, they knew that's what I wanted to do, and why would they stop me? You had to go. You got to go somewhere. You could go to the Coast Guard. You could enlist in the Merchant Marine. And I just chose the Marine Corps, which is one of those things that you go pick out tomatoes, and you pick out one here, and you leave the other one. So I picked the blue uniform.
And... was it literally the day after you graduated that you went off?
Probably
the
about a week.
About a week. And your brothers, how? What did they think of?
Well, they, you know, so long.
Yeah. Were they proud of you? Was there a sense that our older brother's going in the service and this
well,
is?
Well, you see, David, you got to remember that this was the war years, and that's exactly what's going on. That was the norm of things.
So it was more expected than sitting back and saying,
yeah.
Our brother's heroic.
I'm not going to be here. He's not going to war to save it. He's got to go because everybody else is going.
Yeah.
There was no...
So the whole country's in this thing. What's sense of it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But there were a lot of people who ultimately didn't go. I mean, there were some people in their 20s who ended up working in the Nash factory, for example, making aircraft.
Well, they were 4Fs.
Yeah.
One of my friends, I remember Harold Ogden, they wouldn't let him in because he had perforated eardrums. And that bothered him.
Mm-hmm.
It really bothered him that all his friends were going.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I guess maybe one of the things that one of the guys that I knew fairly well, he was about 3 years older than I was, he went in the Marine Corps and he came back to visit, and I visited him then, and he says, I can't believe I'm back. He was in a drill team in Chicago. He said, how in the world I wound up back in Chicago, 50 miles, everybody else was going off to fight the war. He said, I can't believe it.
Yeah. Well, tell me, so you get your orders, where do you report?
You took the train to San Diego, California. Recruit Depot.
And were you trained in San Diego?
Yeah, that's where we stayed, except the time we were up at Camp Matthews, the rifle range.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about the training in San Diego.
Well, we stayed in tents. It was right next to aircraft manufacturing, and they were always taking off of planes. The gunnery sergeant we had was McCabe. He was a Guadalcanal veteran. We had a couple other ones that were, one whose name is Wadzika. I think he slapped the shit out of one time because I didn't respond exactly the way he wanted. He was masochistic as far as I was concerned. And then we had one guy by the name of Casera, and he was a limited duty Marine. He would never go overseas.
And the day, what was the day like in terms of this training period?
Well, of course, you went through a whole bunch of different things. March, drill, 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 drill. That's supposed to create unity.
And it started at what time in the morning?
Crack of dawn? 5:30.
5:30.
Yeah, 5:30, reveille.
5:30, you had reveille. And is that when you went to eat? Or
you were right after that, about a half hour. You ate about 6 o'clock. And I'll tell you about that, about reveille and breakfast later on in the war years, because that's one of the interesting things about my Marine Corps experience. You drill, and then you would learn to about weapons, how to tear down an M1, put it back together to keep it clean. They were always inspecting your clothes, and you'd have to wash your clothes when you could on Sundays. And at night, we weren't allowed to go to the PX thing. We had to stay there in our tents, and we have to study the Marine Corps manual. That was the Bible of the Marine Corps, and that told you everything you needed to know about the Marine Corps. And they told you a lot about other things, you know, how to take care of yourself, bayonet drills. We'd throw grenades. Man, I could throw a grenade further than I could throw a baseball. I was a grenade-happy Marine anyway.
The day ended when?
After dinner, you usually got off, unless you were the platoon sergeant, the training drill instructor, felt you'd misbehave and hadn't done anything. They'd have you out there drilling till wee hours of the night. But you had to go to bed at 10 o'clock, and boy, if you said it a word, the drill sergeant come along, you're out there.
Push-ups and pull-ups.
Push-ups and pull-ups, and your rifle over and up and back, yeah. Up and back. We would write letters.
How good were you about writing home?
Good. I became, I don't know how they could read the letters, but I wrote them. You become more familiar with your family because you're writing people you had never saw before, because they thought it was their duty to write them in the military. And so you'd respond to get mail. And mail call was probably, other than pay call, was the two most important things in the Marine Corps.
Yeah. Was there a sense in the Marine Corps at this point that the Corps was the highest units in the most effective units in the military?
Oh my God, David, you don't know how they drill you on that. You're the best fighting man, you're the toughest man. They drilled you constantly to build up your esteem and your morale. The other thing, going back to, they did about the hatred of the Japanese.
Some of these guys had already fought the Japanese.
That's right. Some of these guys you ran across were Guadalcanal heroes.
And how did they describe the kind of training and preparation you needed to have to fight them, and how did they describe the Japanese?
Well, they described the Japanese, they never said anything good about the Japanese, except that they were very ferocious fighters. Let's see, how do I explain that? Unless you've seen a banzai charge, you've been a part of it, you know, they were crazy as hell, you thought.
They
were tenacious.
There was, even though they detested the Japanese, they also conveyed to you that they were really tough fighters. You're going to have to be well-trained to defeat them.
That was the one thing they did. They told you that you better participate in these drills with the thought that you're going to need every damn thing we're teaching you. But if you don't, you're going to be a dead Marine. And boy, they put the fear of that philosophy into you because they knew it was right. And they knew that from their experience, that it left a lot of guys over there on these islands that didn't pay attention, that didn't learn how to take care of themselves.
Now, did you do practice for seaborne landings in basic? Or
no.
Did you? Not in basic.
No.
Okay.
No. Not until you get into a unit, a combat infantry unit.
Mm-hmm. So you finished up your basic. That was about how long?
What was it? 10 weeks, 12 weeks, somewhere in there?
Yeah, mine was about 3 months, as I recall, in Vietnam, preparation for Vietnam. Yours may have been about the same.
Well, they shortened it because they needed people.
Ah.
I can't remember how long it was.
And where did you go from basic in San Diego?
I went to the Camp Matthews to teach in the rifle range.
So they identified you right in basic as somebody who was very talented with a weapon.
Yeah. And I learned all about the carbines and the 45s and the rising sub, Thompson sub and the like.
And this was, where was Matthews?
It was just north of San Diego.
Okay.
Well, you know where La Jolla is?
Yes.
Okay. It was actually at La Jolla Junction. Okay. US 1.
Yeah. Sure. And you were there at Matthews?
What's the 101? 101.
101.
101.
You were at Matthews for how long?
Oh, four, five, 6 months.
So in that period of time, you trained quite a few people, plus you were learning yourself, I gather.
Yeah, well, I was went to the MPs, too.
Okay.
And
what did you do during your off time?
Write letters, go to the movies, go to the PX and have a few beers.
Did you go downtown into the...
Yeah, you go into San Diego, but it was so full of military people, and you go in La Jolla. La Jolla was a beautiful town in those days. It wasn't crowded and congested and expanded like it is now. When I first went back to La Jolla, I couldn't believe it, but it was a beautiful place. Oh, it's a beautiful place. It's fantastic. You'd do that. You'd go to Los Angeles. You'd hitchhike to Los Angeles.
As you were, you finished up your advanced training, you teach for a while, you teach other Marines, small arms, etc. And then you go into the MPs. How long are you in the MPs for?
Well, it was in the same place as Camp Matthews.
Yeah.
Same place. They just transferred me from doing one thing to another thing. To MPs.
A couple of months,
perhaps? Yeah, maybe so.
And what did you do? What sort of things did you do in the MPs?
Well, there was an ammunition depot, and you guarded the ammunition depot.
And how about dealing with those wayward soldiers who got drunk in town? And did you have responsibility for rounding them up and getting them back?
No.
You did not?
No. The only time I got in trouble, one time I was drinking tequila, and I wound up at the San Diego Naval Hospital there. And that poison in the damn tequila. Oh, God.
Well, what about as an MP? Were you responsible for gathering up the others?
No.
Just protecting the ordnance.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And okay, so after Matthews, let's see, this would have been what, December of 43?
Maybe.
And you went, what was your assignment then?
I went to Camp Pendleton.
Ah.
Camp Pendleton. We were in a replacement battalion, and we went to Maui, Hawaii, on a ship. That is one of the things that I'll try to add some of the levity on the thing. One of the things most visible is seeing a battalion of Marines seasick. You've never seen anything quite like it, because they're just heaving all day and night. You go into the head with the bathroom, and there would be Marines heaving. They'd be heaving over the side of the ship. It was awful. It was horrible sitting out there, and because that ship would go up, down, and that's what got you.
Mm-hmm.
We were escorted out of San Diego by balloons, the air, what do you call them? Balloons.
Yeah, the dirigibles.
Dirigibles, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We were escorted out.
And this would have been, so you went to Maui, would this have been about January 44, December 43, roughly?
Somewhere near, yeah.
Yeah. And in Maui, so you took a ship to Maui. Mm-hmm. How long were you in Maui?
Well, they were building this camp. And we were helping put up tents, covering the woodwork, the pyramidal tents. And That's what we were doing, and we would be assigned to a unit. And I was assigned to, I started out with K Company, 3rd Battalion, 24th Marines. And I was in there, and then I was able to get transferred to Headquarters Company, 3rd Battalion, 24th Marines, as a intelligence. And that was more rewarding, more interesting. And
what sort of things did you do there when you were with the intelligence unit of the battalion?
Well, I became a pretty good map reader. They bring out these maps that they would take from aerial photographs. Mm-hmm. And I could pretty well read those. And I learned enough Japanese that I could, you know, ask them to surrender and tell them I'd give them water, friend or the like, you know. And we just learned how to interview any prisoners we would find. But map reading was our thing, and identifying units by their dog tags or the like. We were trained in all those kinds of things.
Did you have a sense that you had gone from paradise to paradise when you went from La Jolla to Maui?
David, I still love Hawaii. It's the most beautiful place. I mean, despite the fact that I was in the Marine Corps, I really loved Hawaii. I can still picture someone who... I remember I was on guard duty one night, and actually that moon was... It was like the moon is here. But we were on the base of Haleakala, the volcano, and you felt that moon was going right through you. I can still picture that moon in Hawaii, and I can still picture the beaches we went to. Because we get one day a week liberty, and we go down to the towns of Kahului and Wailuku and Lahaina and Paia and all these. I still have fond memories of the people there.
They must have been fairly small towns then.
Yes, they were. And they were largely dominated by Japanese. The Japanese were the workers, the Chinese had the money, and the Hawaiians sat around and watched them make money and work. There was tremendous pineapple fields, cane fields, and we walked through those damn cane fields with no air at all. We'd be marching. Oh, God. I remember one time they had us, you know, had these barbed wire, and you had to go underneath it by pulling your arms like that. And my elbows became so inflamed. And other than a hike, I told the doctor, I said, my arms are killing me. He looks, you're going to the hospital right now. So I went back to the hospital because they were really inflamed.
What caused that?
Well, the dirt.
Just the dirt caused it.
Here, okay. The dirt from going like this.
I see. And was there some sense that you guys were getting ready to be shipped?
Oh, hell yeah.
To the Pacific?
We knew that.
You just didn't know when.
You don't know when. And then they tell you you're going to go aboard ship, and you get aboard a troop transport, and you go practice your landings for days and days. And you get out there, and you go down the ropes into the LCVPs, and you ride around and ride around, and they make a drive to the beach. All you're doing is sitting there all day long in that damn boat. You have some rations. Your rifle's getting wet. You're trying to... You got a poncho over you. Oh.
So that's where you practiced your beach assaults, wasn't it, in Hawaii?
Yeah. Most of the time, though, we would just run to the beach and then back off. Sometimes we'd actually land and spread out and go X distance, mm-hmm. and then come back to the, get back on the LCVPs.
And how many of you would get in one LCVP?
50? No! Around 40,
34 at 540. Okay. So it was a couple of squads, basically.
Yeah, right.
In each LCVP,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's where you practice and coming down those ropes, getting into them. Now, that was a big practice because you better not look down because or look up. Because if you look down, your helmet's coming off and everything. And the guy is down there and he's getting beat up. So that's what you practice, going up and down those rope ladders and into the LCVs while the damn swells are going up and down. And the poor coxswain is trying to keep that LCVP so that you can get in.
Yeah, one of the problems we had, as you recall, seeing episodes of the invasion of Normandy, the guys were dropped out too far.
Yeah.
And when they came off the landing craft, they were in over their head with all this heavy equipment, and some of them just drowned. Were you guys trained for that? I guess the pilot of the LCVP was trained to make sure he got you guys in close enough so that...
Well, let me tell you what you would do. You get in those LCV beat and then make a run to the beach and then hit that coral. And it's like you get in that car and you're going 50 miles an hour per hour against a concrete wall. That's what it felt like.
Wow.
And you hit that thing and, man, it jars the hell out of you. And it tears the bottom of the boat out. You get in that water and you got your marine boondockers, as they call them, going across that coral. And if you fall, you're going to get cut and hurt. So you got to be careful. You got to be dang careful. You get over the side, you stand on your boat feet, and get out of there as fast as you can so that coxswain can get that back up that boat and get it up and go get another group of Marines to come in.
So when did you get orders, or when were you boarded on a ship and you knew, well, this is it. We're going deep into the Pacific to invade some of the Japanese held islands.
Okay. We landed on Saipan in June of 44, June 19th, I believe. June something. So we probably boarded that ship 6 weeks before.
And you sailed straight across the Pacific?
No, you go to Honolulu, pick up supplies, get more training. And you pick up your convoy. Because you weren't going anywhere unless we have a convoy. Mm-hmm. And the fastest ship that goes on could only go as fast as the slowest ship could go. So you didn't lose anybody. And you would circle around and you zigzag, zigzag. And they'd tell you, be careful, or, you know, stand tall because we're going to make a sharp turn. And they would practice their maneuvers. And then you see some of the destroyers practicing with their guns, too. We just have destroyer escorts escorting us. Sometimes you see a few planes, but...
But you guys were all in basically cargo ships.
Well, we call it troop transport.
Troop transport ships, which was the same as a cargo ship, basically.
Well, it's cargo, yeah. Except that they got the bunks going up.
Right.
What, six or eight crawling up, stepping on people.
Now you got your orders, and you... Did you stop at Midway on the way over, or one of the islands? You just went...
We went straight to Saipan. But it was a long trip because it was still... That was a long way on those ships. And, of course, we would be all informed about what was going on at the time. There would be a 30-day, 35-day air bombardment of the island and battleships and cruisers blasting the hell out of them for days and days and days, which did nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Tore up the houses. But
they were all dug in.
Dug away in, yeah.
In bunkers and what have you. So the bombing didn't affect them. Now, Were you part, was the entire 4th Division, Marine Division, going on these ships?
There was one Army Division that was on Saipan. I think it was the 27th Division. And where's my book?
Right here.
Here's my book. This will show you here. Here's Maui, and here's Saipan. That's a long way when you're going that way.
Right.
But we would go around. See, we would go around these islands practicing our maneuvers, and then we'd stop here in Oahu to get supplies and to get the convoy ready. Here's Saipan. So you. You got some good pictures of it. Yeah, this is what it looked like. That's Marapi Point. That could be me along there, I doubt it. But it could be, because I was at Marapi Point. We call it Suicide Hill, too. But anyways, what was I looking for?
Probably the Army Division.
What did it... That's in there somewhere. I don't know how to, I don't want to bother now looking for it.
Well, we'll get it between now and when we finish this interview, we'll get the number of the unit.
Yeah.
I can look that up.
There was about 20, the Marine Division, the 4th Marine Division, when it had its full complement, would it be about 20,000 men. And that would include... that would be artillery and our tanks and the like. But it would also include some of the specialized units. The forward observers for the Navy. Those poor bastards, they join the Navy, think they're going to be a ship, and they wind up in the lines with a Marine unit. It was like the Navy guys, they go in the Navy, they get put in the dang... medical corps, and they wind up as Marines, and they got to be more than Marines to be a corpsman.
So when you get off Saipan, at what point, you arrive, you've been on the ship for 6 weeks, at what point do you know you're going ashore, and were you involved, was Saipan... were the Japanese defeated on Saipan, or were you guys going to be assigned the duty to go in and assault the Japanese units there?
Well, we were landing. It'll show you in that book our landing patterns, and I could show you where I landed. And David, when I landed on Saipan, first thing I ran into, there was a gasoline dump, and it had trench around it, and I jumped in the trench, and here's the trench, and these are the gas cans that had been exploded tonight. I was here, right here. The first thing that happened to me, artillery shell hit right here.
So right next to you.
Right next to me. And, of course, you could see bodies in the air. And, of course, the debris, the sand, and you can't see much. It's pretty dark from the debris. But, man, it shook the hell out of you. And here you are. This one's landing here. You know more are coming.
So this was your first experience on Saipan.
Yeah, right.
Literally, you just landed and...
Wham!
This artillery shell lands.
But you could hear all the machine gun fire and the rifle fire.
So you guys weren't going in to clean up. You guys were going in to kill the Japanese.
That was our assignment. You take Saipan.
Saipan was a big island. One of the biggest of the...
Marianas.
The islands that we invaded, and the biggest island in the Marianas.
Yeah.
How many... any idea how many Japanese were on that island on Saipan?
It'll tell you in that book.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
How long?
It was pretty heavily defended.
How long were you on Saipan? How long did it take you and your...
About 30 days.
30 days to defeat the Japanese. And day by day, what was the fighting like?
Well, there's no such thing. You can't ask that question, David, because there's no way I can tell you, because I can tell you all instances. I can tell you one of the stupid things I did.
Tell us some of the stories. That would be very valuable.
It was hot as hell. So you know what I did? I jumped in the ocean to cool off. You know how dumb that is? It's salt water. Your uniform becomes all salty. And what does that do to your skin and your body? All that salt? Geez, I learned in a quick way. You don't do that, no matter how hot it is. And one night, there was a gap in the line. They have a line that's going like this. It'll show you in there how these lines form and go like this. There was a gap in the line. Well, my battalion commander was the son of the commandant. A.A. Vandegrift Jr. was the commandant, and we had his son as the battalion commander. And all he wanted to do was fight like mad. You know, he thought he can volunteer us for everything. Well, there's a gap in the line. So here we are, trying to close that gap at night, marching along there. Guess what's going on? Over there is another Jap movement. We can see the Japanese over there moving to do something. You know, there are times that, you know, that you get caught in tremendous gunfire. There are times that... I can tell you one time we got caught, and Vandegrift was out there directing fire, and we were caught in machine gun fire. And I was, this was a little bit of hill, and I was down like this. I stuck my ass up like this, hoping I'd get a bullet in there, and I'd get the hell out of there. And a bullet in the ass is not going to hurt you. I mean, it's going to hurt, but it's not going to be life-threatening. I'm up there like this. Get the hell me out of this damn war.
So you, at this point, you're still in intelligence?
No. Okay. I just was going into intelligence then.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I was. Yes, I was. Yes,
so
I was.
You were at battalion headquarters.
Yeah.
With a battalion commander who wanted you all right at the front lines.
Yeah.
Engaging the enemy at every
one
turn.
One night, that damn colonel, he was a good Marine. There was a lot of infiltrating going on. So he sent me on one night to be a listening post. So I go up there in this listening post all by my lonesome. I got a 45 here and an M1 here. And I could hear these Japanese up there talking. I could hear them. So I get my 45 out, and I got it like this. I could hear them coming. And when that guy got in front of me, it went bam, 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 bam. 10 rounds. I picked up my M1. Bam, 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 8 rounds. The colonel sent somebody and said, "What the hell's going on up there?" That guy, I kicked him in the morning. He was full of lead. I mean, I don't think I missed one damn shot. I kicked him. He was just full of lead. You know what? It wasn't a Japanese soldier rifle. I don't think it was. It may have been a Japanese water boy or something, because that's all they're looking for is water. That's what we have surmised.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's all he had. He didn't have anything else that would...
Of course, you had no way of knowing until you saw him.
Hell, I didn't know. I could hear him talking, but I didn't... So, anyway. I got caught in machine gun fire. I was leading some tanks. And they opened fire on us. So I got underneath the tank. And guess what? That tank decided it's going to move. And I'm underneath that tank trying to... protect myself from this damn machine gun fire we're getting. Jesus. Then I remember going on all these stories about Saipan. I remember walking down a path, single file column. The guy behind me, bam! He said, "That guy over there, that Jap that I just killed, was going to have his rifle sights set on you." And he saw it and went, bam! And we just kept right on going. Stuff. Then I went up and talked to some Japanese into surrendering. And they threw a grenade at me. I could have beat Jesse Owens by 100 yards in a 100-yard dash because I could hear him, what he was doing. The Japanese grenades, you detonate them like this. There's a little round detonator cap. Like, and I heard him hit that rock. Get out of there, man. And I was up there trying to tell him to surrender. I'll give him water, you know, and it was damn Japanese Marines. Well, these are all kinds of little stories.
What was the conditions like on Saipan for you guys? The heat, the food, water?
Oh, they kept us with water. But I'll tell you what, Bill Cross is smarter than a lot of people. As soon as I found one or two dead Marines, I took his canteen. So I always had extra canteens of water with me. I was not going to die of thirst on that island. The weather was not bad. It rained at night. You'd cover up with a poncho and you'd be all right in the morning, be dry. The other thing I do is when I found the dead Marine, I'd take his grenade hang. So I always had grenades and water.
What about the heat? How hot would it get during the day?
It wasn't bad. Mm-hmm. Wasn't bad at all. Sure, it was hot, but it was in the summertime too. But it wasn't bad.
What about equipment? Did you guys have everything you needed? Did you have the weapons you needed? Was the boots, etc., sufficient to keep your feet protected in these conditions?
Well, you see, what they did during those times was the wrong thing to do. You would dub your boots. You would take your combat boots and you'd rub this like wax in it, you know, to make them waterproof. Dumb move, because there was no sweat then. No ventilation.
Way to get the sweat out. Yeah.
So everybody is running around with bad feet. Mm-hmm. And you, if you brought a change of socks, you were lucky.
Food? What did you have for food?
D rations. And there was it was about that long.
So a small box?
Yeah, a rectangular box. It was covered with a wax type of thing. You open it up and you could find a chocolate bar, which was not chocolate. It was the worst tasting chocolate in the world. You get a little pack of cigarettes and you get some little crackers type of thing. And then you get a little round can, and there were three different ones. You'd get one at bacon and eggs, beef stew. There's one more. What the hell was the other one? And so you'd get dysentery from the beef stew. Then you, cheese. That was it. So you'd eat the cheese to stop you up. Then you get stopped up and you go back to eating the other things. So that you get, we learn fast how to take care of ourselves. I'm only 18 at the time.
You trading stuff for other stuff? Were you trading any of those D rations to other guys for?
Hell no! Nobody wanted those damn things. Why would you trade something that you didn't want? No.
Hot meals only when you got back on the ship, I guess.
Right. Well, no, that's not true. Mm-hmm. I'll get back to that one later on. But anyways. The rations this kept you alive. I remember one time I found a chicken. I killed that chicken and cooked it, but I didn't cook it well enough. You know, I built a little fire there with a little bamboo leaves and the like. And damn, but I had chicken dinner that night.
What Saipan? How long were you on the island?
About 30 days.
About 30 days on the island. And Japanese, did they surrender at all, or
well, this did is you where guys I'm gonna take get, remember I said Marapi Point there? Mm-hmm. Okay, Marapi Point. You went down that hill, and here was a coral, acres of coral. And underneath those hills you saw were caves. Well, the Japanese were being pushed to Marapi Point. And they were gathering there, and they were jumping in the water, trying to, you know, commit suicide. The ones that were not out there were in these caves. Let me forget to tell you about one of the caves. Interesting story. So they sent us out there to try to get the Japanese to stop. Well, they had a LCVP type boat out there with a loudspeaker talking to them in Japanese, asking them to surrender. They were throwing babies in there and the like, and we just wanted to stop that nonsense. But they continued. None of them really surrendered, did it? But what happened was, those caves were loaded with Japs. Some alive, some dead. When you went in them, it was just a pool of blood all around, dead nips. Now, but anyway,
smell must have been atrocious.
Oh, worse than atrocious. But when I'm standing out there in that coral, I'm standing next to a guy from New York by the name of Charlie Kuntz. And he gets one right in the head from the cave. The guy in that cave was an excellent shot because he was killing people like going out of style. And Charlie fell in that water, in that those seawater from the water running over this coral. And that pool of blood, just red blood, came up. I can still picture that. Okay.
You can stand up and walk around a little bit, Bill. No need to sit there. Okay, we're going.
Well, I told you about those caves. There's that road going down there. And they're still alive was in there. Well, we went back on the top of that hill, and these crazy Marines. Marines are board-certified nuts when it comes to combat. They would take Bangalore torpedoes. You know what that is?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
And then take grenades and mortar shells and all kinds of. They'd wrap them together on that Bangalore torpedo and lower it on a rope, and they'd swing that thing back and forth. Get it going, and let it go in there, and that thing would go off, and just blow the shit out of
anybody in there. Yeah,
the sound would kill you anyway. And they were having the best time, seeing which would make the most noise, probably kill the most Japs. Well, the other cave I wanted to tell you about was a cave that you could go down into. And around in the horseshoe type thing was a series of caves, like.
And could you stand up in these caves?
Yeah. Oh gosh, yes.
You could walk standing up. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. You'd have to bend over a little bit sometimes, but by and large, you could stand up there. Because I went into them. Well, anyways. We knew those Japanese were in there, and they decided to run a flamethrower tank in there, because the tank could actually go down into it, and just blast the hell out of them with a napalm. And so we backed away from the perimeter so we wouldn't get hurt by the flamethrower, and backed away. There was nothing there. And they tank backed out, and we said, now we could go forward to the cave. When I got there was a woman laying there. I didn't know she was real. I didn't know that. Yeah, I guess. I'm not sure. Well, for the Marine Boone doctors, I'm going to find out if this person is alive or dead. I kicked as hard as I could. And it was a woman. She got up and started cussing me. She was a camp follower. We figured it out. And she must have been a number of men there. Oh, she cussed me out. Well, all we did was turn them into the interrogators, and then took them back to prisoner of war.
She wasn't Japanese. She was
Probably not.
She's probably a native of Saipan or one of the islands.
I know she wasn't not a native.
Oh, okay.
I knew that. Okay. I knew that. She was not a native.
Where do you think she was from? Any idea? One of the islands nearby?
Probably. Mm-hmm. Probably. And then the other time, I was a guy by the name of Carl. Oh, I got a letter in there from his wife. He died recently. I wrote it to his wife. Hubble. Carl Hubble and I were, as I told you, I was great grenade happy. Well, we were wandering around just, we had that kind of leisure to kind of come and go as long as they didn't really assign us anything. So I just took an incendiary grenade and I saw this like mound of debris and stuff. I didn't know what it was, but hell, might as well throw a grenade today. So I threw that grenade in there, incendiary grenade, and the smoke started coming out. So we were walking off. We heard a baby cry. Oh, shit. What's going on now? Here's Bill Cross, big hero. Started pulling all that debris off of there, trying to get out the fire, smoke coming out. Take off my...
Your belt?
Belt. Go in there with a knife. Took out eight people.
Eight people were in there?
Eight people were in there, and there was a guy right behind me that could have stabbed me. I was pulling people out. It was a family. They were natives. They weren't Japanese soldiers. But who knows what they could have done. One of them could have stabbed me easily. But we pulled the baby out and pulled all of the baby was born during the bombardment. We figured that out. And then another time, I was just firing sort of maybe at random. How did that happen? Anyway, allegedly, and I don't know that I did, I shot a baby. That's what the woman said. That was me. The mother said it. And the bullet went through the throat here. David, there wasn't a single ounce of blood, but you could hold that baby up and see the clean hole. You could see one out the other. Mm. They were treating the baby at one of the aid stations when I got there. Mm. And that's when they blamed me. I don't know if it was me, but it could have been me because I was firing at random.
So you came off of Saipan, and did you get any R&R or...
Well, that's why. How much? What time is it now?
We're gonna stop in about 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay. Now, then we found a area where we could quote unquote relax. The relax was we're gonna go take Tinian, the island next to us. Well, this is another sight that you don't want to see, is Marines with dysentery going all day and night. Because they just got off of combat and food and everything, they developed this dysentery because they were getting hot food. Because the cooks had set up and the like. But all day and all night, these Marines, you know, were trying to sleep. You could hear these Marines just, some of them didn't make it, you know, they're just going, their pants and the like.
Yeah.
It was a horrible, horrible few days. I don't remember how many days we stayed there. One of the things I did while I was there, and that I went over and watched some of the doctors working in a field hospital, and they were putting a Marine's leg back together. They were drilling holes in it. And I'd never seen it. Of course, you probably haven't ever seen it either. They were just drilling, hand drilling, so they could put screws in this Marine's legs. And you could see all the wounded. And you'd hear stories that there was one, and I know this is true, there was one plane that was going to be taking off, and they said he had so many hours to get to Pearl Harbor or the Marines would die because they had lost so much blood, and they had to get him to some place so they can take care of him at a higher level than what they mm-hmm. could in his field hospitals. And his plane was taking these two Marines that were just badly beat up. There was an awful lot. And the hospital ships were all out there, you know. And they were, the LCVPs were ferrying the dead and the injured all day and all night long.
Why don't we stop there, Bill? And okay. We'll pick it up in a day or so. Thank you.
Okay.